Hello, Michael.
Hey, Matt. Great to be with you.
Thank you for filling in. Bill is out this week. Why don't you tell everyone who may not know, I'm sure some do, a little bit about you and the work that you do.
Let's see. So I host a podcast once a week called Intersection for Aslan Media, and I work as a contributor and producer for a daily political talk show called The Majority Report, which is hosted by Sam Cedar. And I do stuff like this, and I publish articles, and recently, I guess my last couple of pieces were in Al Jazeera America and Huffington Post.
Well, cool. Well, say hi to Sam. He and I used to do a lot of MSNBC together back in the old days. It's been a while, but...
Oh, I'll definitely tell him you say hi. Absolutely.
We used to do, like, Dylan Radigan, different things.
Like, oh, that, right. From time to time. Okay.
Yeah. And I think other stuff, too. Jank Yulgar show, and different things. But good to have you. Thanks for filling in for Bill. And there was a lot of different topics this week. Bill and I have really kind of beat to death Obamacare and New Jersey and Virginia. So I wanted to ask you about some different things. And there's, I guess, a New Republic piece out talking about how Elizabeth Warren could be a real threat to Hillary Clinton. I guess the conventional wisdom is that Hillary can't be stopped, but I'd love to get your take on that.
I mean, obviously the conventional wisdom was that she couldn't be stopped before. I thought what was interesting about the piece you're talking about in the New Republic about Elizabeth Warren and Hillary Clinton is the fact that even beyond whether or not she can be stopped or actually defeated by Warren in a primary, the point is more that this division in the Democratic Party between a kind of much more progressive base, which is much more concerned about economic inequality, Wall Street, reining in financial excesses, and the kind of Democratic establishment is probably clearer than ever. And it's also maybe a little bit less culturally focused than that division used to be. The kind of cultural politics of the Democratic Party is pretty uniformly progressive. So the distinctions are really on these kind of economic opportunity and power issues. And obviously nobody kind of speaks to that base better than Elizabeth Warren. And she's really effective and she's really genuine. So the notion of the piece is she might actually have a shot at winning, but she also could actually genuinely shift the terms of the debate and possibly force Hillary to new places. So it's right. A really interesting article.
It's fascinating. And I mean, we've done so much introspection on the right, so much looking at this GOP civil war, Rand Paul versus Chris Christie or whatever. But I think we've really kind of ignored mostly this interesting dynamic on the left. Now, I guess the one question I would have for you is, do you see this as entirely healthy? Or do you think that this could be a schism which could actually cost Democrats the election?
I don't think it would cost Democrats the election. I mean, obviously, we're going pretty far out. So, you know, we never know what may or may not happen over the next couple of years. But I think overall it's very healthy because I think that there's this very large kind of swath of the electorate that actually cuts across a lot of ideological lines, that doesn't want to see cuts in Social Security or Medicare, that's really skeptical about Wall Street. And nobody's really speaking clearly to them. And that leaves a political void. And I think that progressive politics should be in that void. And having Democratic Party leaders that actually are serious about those issues is pretty essential for the future of the party.
I mean, is this as simple as saying it's a left versus centrist argument that Warren is just more liberal? Or is it a different paradigm than we've seen in the past?
That's a really good question. I don't think it's just as simple as that, because I think there's an insider-outsider component. There's a bottom-up versus top-down. I think – and also, you know, even how we're defining our terms. If you go and you did some poll across the country on what do you think about too big to fail banks, or what do you think about corporate control of the political process, or what do you think about, safeguarding Social Security or something – The quote liberal position is definitely going to be overwhelmingly popular when it's polled. So, I don't know if it's just a simple liberal versus centrist. I wouldn't use those terms. I mean, I have no problem like being called a liberal or being progressive or whatever, but I don't think that particularly the way we normally use those words, really gets to the division there.
It's really weird because, you know, we like to try to, like, put things in these neat little compartments and use code words like he's the Tea Party candidate, he's the establishment candidate. But politics is really getting messy. And it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like Elizabeth Warren's politics in some ways would be like people like Tim Carney, who writes for the Washington Examiner, who's a conservative, but he hates, mm-hmm. you know, big business and
he's worried about, like, regulatory capture, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And people like Buddy Romer, who, you know, talked about issues like that. I think that in a weird way, there may be some conservatives who like at least some of Elizabeth Warren's agenda.
I think that that's very true, particularly on a grassroots and actual voting level. You know, I know less about Buddy Romer, but I know it's with some of, you know, the real division with some libertarians, even ones like Tim Carney, who I do think are probably a lot more sophisticated, is they don't necessarily want to actually, they can, you know, they describe regulatory capture or something like that. And then their reasons, their sort of explanation of the causes of that are pretty going to be pretty radically different than someone like me or Elizabeth Warren. But I do think on the on a grassroots level, there's a huge opening for someone coming out and just saying, hey, look, let's make, you know, let's clean up corporate money out of politics. Let's make it much more genuinely accountable. I actually forget the guy's name, but in the Elizabeth Warren piece, Schreiber, Noam Schreiber, who wrote that, mentioned some a Democratic Senate candidate in South Dakota who's running, you know, like pretty close in the polls in a race where that shouldn't really even be anything. You know, it should be a Republican win, no problem. But he's running purely on corporate domination of government. I mean, it's kind of interesting. I remember when Ralph Nader ran and I was a teenager in 2000. This is a lot of the stuff he talked about. And, you know, maybe he was, you know, it was a mistake to run and he was, you know, a little wrong prescriptively, but he's pretty right on descriptively.
What do you think it is out there? So there clearly is a zeitgeist out in America. I'm sitting in Washington, D.C., so I'll play
the popular. I'm in New York, so I'm probably not out there either.
The Acela Express DMZ this week. But clearly there's something bubbling up out there that's changed, right? Because – you know, in the old days, if you talked about these issues, you were sort of a fringe candidate and you could never really win. But now it does feel like something has changed. But I can't put my finger on why that is. Was it the bailouts? Was it, you know, what do you think specifically has caused this change, you know, in the political mood?
Well, I think it's a whole... it's a lot of things, and I think unaccountable bailouts is certainly part of it. How we, you know, the perception was we took care of the banking sector, didn't do much for homeowners. I think more broadly, it's just, you know, the economy still isn't working for a lot of people. And I also think that there's, I think Chris Hayes talks about this in his, Twilight of the Elites, just the idea that we've reached a critical point of people who are kind of like doing what they're supposed to do. They sent their kids to good colleges. They, you know, they saved, they did X, Y, and Z. But I mean, yeah, I think that the perception is that, and I don't think it's just the perception. I think it's very accurate that more and more people who have, you know, done, quote, the right things are just simply, you know, they're just not getting ahead. They're not getting what they need. And then the corollary of that is just these constant examples of Wall Street, of, you know, even like BP, of people just doing these kind of disastrous and probably in many cases criminal things and really just not, you know, I mean, you know, I think it was HSBC a couple of months ago, you know, laundering money for drug cartels and Al-Qaeda. And you get to a point where you see this and you think, you know, okay, so fine. I, you know, and I can't even sort of get my kid an internship, even though I'm, you know, going into debt to send them to a private college.
Right. Well, that's the line that Chris Matthews uses a lot, which I think is really good about people who work hard and play by the rules. And
That's an old Clinton line, yeah.
Maybe that's an old Clinton line. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the expectation that you should be able to get ahead and make a better life by just, you know, by working hard and playing by the rules. And more, I guess, it's stuff. I do want to ask you, in terms of the politics of it, my sense is that it would be easier for a woman like Elizabeth Warren to deprive Hillary Clinton of the nomination yet again than it would be for a man. Do you think that gender plays a role, and that might, you know, be another factor that would help Warren?
I think Democrats would like to make history again, and I think that probably that would help her in a primary. But I think, you know, a Hispanic candidate could also, you know, maybe there's no sort of obvious choice there. But I think, I think it would be nice, obviously, to elect a woman president.
And I feel like
a woman. And it helps, yeah.
Yeah, well, not only elect a woman, but just to deprive Hillary yet again would be bad form, especially for a party that's really used the war on women meme so effectively. I mean, to have a man yet again keep her from the nomination would be at least ironic. So let me ask you, because I do feel like timing is very important in politics. I mean, I think that Barack Obama was pretty shrewd to seize on running when he did. If he had waited a few more years, he might have had all these Senate votes that he would, you know, he might have gotten older and a little less hip. I mean, he really, you got to strike when the iron is hot, you know, lightning doesn't strike twice. All these cliches are really sort of true. And isn't there a sense that Elizabeth Warren, the time is now, like she may not be as appealing in 4 or 8 years?
You know, I don't know about the second part, but I think that the time is, I think this could be an incredibly ripe time for her for all the reasons we talked about. I think, you know, in terms of 4 or 8 years, I think when you have someone like Elizabeth Warren, who really her brand is built around a very substantive mission, as long as those things are a big problem. So maybe, in 48 years, if all of a sudden there's real progress in rebuilding, you know, middle class and addressing working class issues and real reform on Wall Street, then maybe, right? But I think that, you know, what she's trying to do and the issues she works around are pretty, they don't have the same type of transience that maybe in some ways Obama had, you know, in a very specific, like, I'll be an anecdote tonally to Bush in some ways or something like that, and even tonally to the Clintons. I think her issues are a little bit kind of longer range than that, but I do think, you know, the first part of what you said is totally right, that the timing for her right now would make a lot of sense.
So having said all that, and you know, I know that, you know, the prognostication prediction game is fraught with danger, but I do want to sort of put you on the spot and ask you, I mean, you know, what do you think the odds are that Warren runs, and what do you think the odds are Hillary becomes the nominee?
Oh, wow. Andrew Cuomo will become the nominee. No, I'm just kidding. I think it's very hard to give specific numbers. I think that right now, at this point, you still have to probably assume Hillary becomes the nominee. But I would put that maybe more in like the 60 or 70% range versus the 90 or 100% that a lot of people would. And I would put Elizabeth Warren running at a little above 50, just so I could give you some type of prediction.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. And I mean, I agree with you in the sense that I think the conventional wisdom that Hillary will essentially have clear the field and will, you know, sort of be coronated. That's sort of the conventional wisdom, and I don't buy that. So I'm not
I don't really buy that either.
Yeah, I mean, this is an opportunity, and you know, it may be Elizabeth Warren. She may never have another opportunity. I mean, you know, fans of this show would not be happy if I did not use a sports reference. So I will use a sports reference. I'm in Washington here, and our local team, the Washington Nationals, also known as the Nationals. Mm-hmm. They went to the playoffs last year, and they decided to sit their ace pitcher, Strasburg, who had just been off a year earlier, had Tommy John surgery on his arm.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote at the time, and I wasn't alone, but a lot of people wrote, you know, look, you may never make it back to the show. There are people, you know, Don Mattingly played his entire career in New York for the Yankees of all teams and never made it to a World Series. And so there's no guarantee that you will ever
be back. LeBron left Cleveland, right?
Right. Yeah. And so here, yeah. You know, the Nationals have this chance. They make it to the playoffs, and they decide to bench Steven Strasburg. They don't play him in the playoffs, and of course they ended up losing to St. Louis. And my argument at the time was, they're assuming that they've got this dynasty and that they're going to be back. You know, of course they didn't make it back this year, which proves the point, that they're going to be back every year and they'll have a decade of dominance. And I say, no, you've got to take your chances while you can. And maybe the same way with Elizabeth Warren, that, you know, you got to strike while the iron is hot. And so assuming that she's just going to sit by and let Hillary waltz into the nomination, and never mind her, but Joe Biden and Andrew Cuomo and everybody else, I think is maybe to underestimate the ambition and the political, you know, savvy of some of these, you know, other Democrats.
I think that's true. And I think also the other point that Schreiber made that I think is really important to keep hitting is just that her calculus, not that she isn't obviously really personally ambitious, but she's so identified with this particular set of policies and this mission that her calculus is a little bit different. So that for her, running a really serious, incredible campaign where she made an actual real dent on the debate would very particularly for someone like her actually make it worth running, right? Like even more so than someone just kind of striking while the iron's hot, or someone like John Edwards who would say, oh, you know, I'm really running on poverty or whatever, but that's just the opportunity of the moment. He doesn't, you know, his investment was not like, I want to restructure Democratic politics for the next, you know, decades. But with her, it is.
Yeah, and so she could argue, maybe even just to argue to herself, convince herself, but she could legitimately argue that by running, even if she doesn't win the nomination, she can change the narrative of the debate, maybe force other candidates to adopt or co-opt some of her ideas and affect public policy that way. Very interesting. Totally. We'll keep an eye on that. I want to segue a little bit. You know, Bill and I, because of what we do, we have to dabble in everything. We have to talk about, you know, you name it, we have to know a little bit about it. I don't think either of us posture ourselves as foreign policy experts. And, you know, actually foreign policy, not just here in the DMZ, but everywhere, has kind of taken a back seat since probably since Syria. And so, but there are some things happening and some talks and stuff in Geneva, and wanted to see if you might bring us up to speed a little bit on that.
Well, I guess working backwards, looked like that the Iranians and the P5 plus one, which is the group of Western nations led by the United States negotiating with them, were on the verge of signing some type of preliminary deal, which was actually detonated by the French. So I don't know. Maybe now, like progressive internationalists like me are ready to bring back freedom fries. But
right, there was a Wall Street Journal piece the other day, you know, praising the French for their hawkishness, or they're at least being tough on Iran in terms of their nuclear ambitions.
Yeah, I mean, I think again that the whole thing about this conversation is there's so many assumptions kind of in it. I think people who have who really kind of focus on this stuff, certainly, you know, even much more than me, and I focus on it, that it's definitely part of my job, part of what I do. There's even question to begin with about what really the nature of that ambition is. It isn't even broadly accepted amongst kind of specialists that they even necessarily want to actually take that final step to building an actual weapon. They probably want the capacity.
Yeah.
It's definitely not necessarily the case that they want the actual to weaponize it. They're also, you know, their strategy and their motivations for doing this are very deterrent based. I mean, you know, one of the things when you kind of get into Iran is that they're in some ways, it makes some of their domestic human rights record and other things that are really terrible. You know, I wrote a piece with Reza Aslan about a month ago for the Washington Post about the Baha'i community in Iran, which is, you know, another like little small human rights crisis that really gets very little attention. But in some ways, that those policies are even more obscene when you kind of really get that the Iranians are not driven by this kind of, you know, Fox News conception that they're like these irrational, you know, religious zealots. You know, yes, there's religion, yes, there's conservatism, but ultimately they're actually they're realists, and they're a kind of mid-rank power trying to ensure their stability and ensure their future. And under this new president, with the approval of the supreme leader, it's very genuine that they want a deal. They want to cut something and make something happen. And I think Obama wants to make something happen, and the process will go forward. This didn't end the negotiations, and people didn't leave in a huff. And it is kind of actually telling that, you know, clearly it's the other Western diplomats that are briefing against the French and not the Iranians.
Right.
So well, this process to, will
well, I do want to ask you, I'm sorry, going back to...
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm of the opinion that if they have this, like, latent breakout capacity, that is essentially just as bad as if they went all the way. Because it would mean that in a matter of weeks or months, they could essentially have, you know, weaponry. So to me, that's almost a distinction without a difference. It gives them a public relations ability to say that we're not building a bomb or whatnot. But that's my take. But what's your take? How do other members of the international community?
Well, that time frame. I'm sorry, Matt. Go ahead.
How is that impacting other members of the international community in terms of how they view Iran's enrichment capacity?
Well, the time frame is definitely nowhere near the kind of weeks to months period. So, you know, again, the most, and I think it's obviously in post-Iraq, it's really important to be very careful about these assessments. So according to IAEA, according to even certain U.S. estimates, we're talking about something that's years away. And there's ambiguity in. I think, look, you know, it kind of breaks down to war with Iran is a total disaster on a number of levels. And I think, you know, the overall temperature of the Middle East, would them having that capacity, that weapon, help things? No, not at all. And I don't think anybody really wants that. But again, assessing why they might want it gives us a sense of how they think and how they make policy, which is actually pretty rationally and someone you can make a deal with. In the same way we can make deals with plenty of other countries that we don't, you know, we don't approve their human rights records. We don't like any number of things they may or may not say. It's not about being like fans of the Iranian government, but it is about being realistic about them and not believing this mythology that's been built up, which really could lead us to make totally disastrous decisions that are absolutely unnecessary.
Right. Well, the mythology, though, is, I mean, you know, the movie Argo, of course, was a big hit a year or so ago. And, I mean, obviously, we're still, every calculus involving Iran goes back to 1979. Is that unfair, though? I mean, would you argue that creates the mythology?
I don't know if that creates some of it. I mean, well, I mean, first, so every part of their policy goes back to 1953 when we overthrew Mossadegh, right? So there is this history of grievance on both sides, and that doesn't justify, obviously it doesn't justify the hostage crisis. I think, you know, you look at the hostage crisis, what happened, you know, there was the anniversary of the hostage crisis was a little over a week ago, and in Iran, President Rouhani took no part in celebrating it or in commemorations for it. And the supreme leader issued some very kind of bland statements and renewed his support for the president's diplomacy. And even the hardliners that supported it, you know, they came out and frankly, it's very distasteful and it's very offensive. But there's a lot of, you know, it's a political trope that plays to their constituencies. And that's just a part of politics, mm-hmm. whether it's in Iran or the United States or Russia or China or Zambia. That's just the world we live in. And I, you know, and obviously they're not in a moment of like post-revolutionary fervor right now at all. So I think both sides are going to have to set aside a bit of history and look to the present. You know, I remember when during the Green Revolution, and I don't remember who said this, but, you know, Obama, which was interesting, was one of the reasons he was a little bit, I think he actually played that right in some ways, which is another conversation. But one of the things he said is, he said, look, these guys who lead the Green Movement, like Museveni, like, these are, you know, there's not that big of a difference, right? Like, they're members of this system. And what was, and some Iranian dissident gave an interview to The Guardian or something, and he said, hey, that's like a low blow, man. That's like us saying you're just like Bush. So I think that, you know, that there's real room there, and the room and the opportunity should be taken. I think that's the bottom line.
I was just listening to this podcast on Fresh Air. The author of this book called The Ministry of Guidance invites you to not stay.
Right.
And it was interesting. He talks about how, you know, Iran is one of the most, you know, educated countries in the world, and very sophisticated populace. The thing I didn't know, because you're talking about the culture, is this sulking. I found this really interesting. The Great Sulk, apparently it's part of their culture is to sulk. And I didn't know this, but Ahmadinejad apparently went on a sulk where he basically just wouldn't show up to work for 12 days because he wanted to get somebody fired, and he couldn't get them fired. And so he just like wouldn't come out and like wouldn't talk to anybody. And that's apparently like part of their culture. It didn't work. He had to go back. He ended up having to come back to work. But it is interesting how, like, oh, the other thing that this author was saying is, you know,
it's Hooman Majd, and yes, he's great. Everybody should read him. Yeah,
it was really an interesting conversation. I'm also a fan of Terry Gross and Fresh Air, but he was saying, and now this, you know, this will get me attacked from my conservative friends, but he was saying, like, yes, they do call us the Great Satan, but in fairness, they call each other the Great Satan. Like, this is like part of their, you know. It's sort of like right now we're making excuses for locker room conversation and incognito. Like, this is some of their trash talk a little bit. I don't know if that's true or not, but it is interesting. And you do have to sort of like put yourself in the other guy's shoes a little bit sometimes when you're making decisions based on, you know, foreign policy.
Well, that's totally key. I mean, and empathy is many different things. And empathy, you know, there's a type of empathy that's pretty value neutral. It has nothing to do with approving or condoning of something, but understanding and acting from it. And I think the real bottom line is just that, you know, they're not going to just detonate some nuke in some suicidal act of, you know, Shia frenzy. There's no basis for that. Historically, even under Khomeini, and looking at how they handled being invaded by Iraq, and taking arms from Israel and all these other things. I mean, it's much better to look at them as Machiavellians and robes than religious fanatics. And religion is obviously deployed, and the people bear the brunt of it domestically with some really horrible policies. But fundamentally, in terms of their international position, they're not a suicidal country. They're not a suicidal leadership. And people like Rouhani, I think, to be fair, really do see an opportunity for Iran to play a different role in the region, a different role in the world, and in fact be a lot more prosperous and a lot more better leveraged strategically. Because, you know, that's Rouhani is, you know, a Western-trained, you know, foreign policy think tank guy. You know, that's his back. That's part of his background as well.
True, but you could also argue that you know, the Syrian dictator wanted to be like an ophthalmologist in London. I mean, sometimes these guys have Western backgrounds. It doesn't always make them.
Oh, it's not his background. I don't think it's a Western background thing. It's that he has a view of the world and how Iran can leverage itself in it. That is pretty well. I mean, look, it doesn't involve, you know, being suicidal.
Right.
And even, you know, a guy like Assad, you know, yeah, he inherited the Syria from his dad, and his dad crushed villages, you know, starting, I mean, he's following the family pattern, and it's horrific, but it's, you know, there's some different, I could tell you, I never bought the whole Assad's really a possibly reasonable guy thing. He seemed to me just like a nasty trust fund baby.
Right.
That's what he is.
So yeah. Why are, you know, we talked about France, but I'm still unclear. I mean, they obviously weren't this tough on Saddam Hussein, and Iraq. Why is it that, you know, is this sort of a noble thing, or do they have interests in the region that would that is informing their tough stance on Iran?
Well, the crudest perception, the crudest argument some people have forward is that France is entering into some the possibility of some very big arms deals with Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is virulently opposed to any type of agreement with Iran, like incredibly virulently opposed. So there's a notion that, again, I think maybe there's some truth in it. I think it's a little simplistic, but that France has this kind of angle with Saudi Arabia. They're currying favor. Another notion people have put forward is that really France and the U.S. are playing good cop, bad cop, and that this is coordinated to kind of push for some tighter inspections and some tighter frameworks around a final agreement. And then a third thing that people have forwarded is that this is just, in some ways, even though, again, obviously, like, I agreed with the French on Iraq, I think they were just, you know, they were just, like, accurate. But there is a component of French foreign policy, which is kind of just punching above its weight and trying to stay relevant. And I, you know, I don't think that that's ever not a factor as well when you're talking about them, to be honest.
Sounds interesting. We'll obviously keep monitoring this. I guess lastly, last topic today that I wanted to talk to you about was Richard Cohen's controversial Washington Post op-ed. Why don't you, if you would, set that up, and what was your take on that?
Well, you know, I guess Richard Cohen, I should confess, I never read Richard Cohen unless he pops up with one of these columns, which he does pretty regularly. So I end up reading him a lot.
Yeah, and that may be the whole thing. I mean, their media reporters are essentially this guy. This is a man who has a column and a big perch. And a large megaphone that doesn't really necessarily seem to have much of a base. Like, you know, it's one of those things, right? Like, people read him because he's there, but I don't know that anyone, like, wakes up and says, what does Richard Cohen think about this? So.
What does Richard Cohen think about dating? Yeah, no, I agree. I think, to say the least. Well, I guess basically Richard Cohen was writing I would look to me like a pretty prosaic kind of Cruz versus Christie column. And most of it, I didn't, you know, wasn't all that exceptional. And then he kind of moved into talking, and it was so weirdly set up, because first he said, "Look, the Tea Party's not racist, but like many I think it's something like many Americans with, quote," and this was the big line, "conventional views," looking at Bill de Blasio and his wife, Bill de Blasio being the new mayor of New York City, with a, you know, really, just objectively, like, a very nice family, right? Like, regardless of anything else you thought, like, you know, seeing him and his wife and his multiracial children, you know, makes you surpass your gag reflex.
Yeah.
And then he put in parentheses, also, you know, Shirlene McRae, who's Bill de Blasio's wife, used to be a lesbian.
Yeah.
And he kind of wrote this, like, you know, need I say more? And I have to say, again, not only don't I read them, every single time I see one of these headlines, I get committed. I'm like, I'm not going to read this. I don't care. There's important stuff in the world. And then somehow I click on the link and I read the excerpt and I'm like, oh, my God.
Right.
What's the matter with this guy?
It's weird for a few reasons. One, I don't remember anybody making a big deal out of de Blasio's marriage, or using that against him, or anything during the campaign.
Nobody.
Number two, as Dave Weigel points out, you know, even if he had, you know, changed the word conventional to conservative, conservatives aren't against interracial marriage, and, you know,
then you guys would have something to be offended about.
Absolutely, and Weigel points out things like Jenny Thomas and Clarence Thomas and interracial marriage. Of, you know, she's, you know, right, works here at the Daily Caller, does, you know, sort of seen as a Tea Party activist. I don't know whether anybody has a problem with their interracial marriage. So really the question is, does this say more about Richard Cohen than it does about conventional or conservative Americans? And I think the answer may be yes. This says more about him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we could get into another I think what was interesting is that we could get into a conversation about, you know, we might have some disagreements about, you know, race and the Tea Party. And I think there are issues there. But what I think was fascinating about this was that he – usually when something like this comes up, there's kind of a debate and there's some subtlety about what something means or how somebody was attempting to convey something or the context. This was just like, oh, well, there it is. And very few people in public, you know, American life. I mean, it was even more strong than something Pat Buchanan would write. And Pat Buchanan is the only other person I could think of who does write stuff occasionally that I think is just sort of like objectively racist or anti-Semitic, certainly homophobic. So it was kind of – I mean, it was almost like in that Asif Mamvi clip on The Daily Show where he was talking with that Republican county chair who was saying all that racist stuff. And Asif Mamvi looks at him and he goes, you know, we can hear you, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, we can read you, right?
It's really weird in the fact that it's at the Washington Post and the fact that they seem to be standing by him and the fact that this is like a pattern. And then the fact that,
absolutely,
again, you know, it's not like he has a huge, you know, it seems like a throwback to the old days where if you landed a job as a columnist, you could just write columns and people would have to read you because you were there. You didn't have to have like a fan base or be relevant or drive the discussion or the debate. And it seems like this, he may be like the last columnist in America who who just sort of has a great job without checking off any of the other boxes. So.
No, I mean, I think even, I was even thinking of just like, you know, this is a really crude way of looking at it, but just even as someone who, you know, you've gone through many more, but, you know, I've gone through some tough editing processes getting published. And even like saying, you know, the conventional view and the gag reflex is so offensive in and of itself, but any editor would say, well, what about this poll that says, you know, like 80% of Americans across demographic lines have no problem with interracial marriage. Like, you know, there's only just
nobody at the
things.
Post said, do you think this is right? And should we maybe tone this down
right.
a little bit? And maybe they're, you know, maybe we're at the point now where this is trolling. They're trolling us. And it worked. We're talking about him. Why else would we talk about Richard Cohen? So, you know.
So well, Richard Cohen's actually way ahead of the curve. He was the troll before troll.
Yeah, well played, Washington Post. All right. Well, hey, good conversation. Thank you for stepping up and filling in for Bill. And give us some plugs. How can people keep in touch with you and read your stuff?
Well, first of all, thank you so much. It was tons of fun. And thank you, Bill, for thinking of me to pitch it for you. You can follow me on Twitter at _Michael Brooks. Go to the Majority Report, majority.fm. I host that show once every couple of weeks. Obviously, Sam is great. You should listen to that every day. And on Aslan Media, Intersection. So that's Aslan Media /Intersection. That's a podcast that goes up once a week on mainly the foreign policy front. A lot of Iran coverage, actually.
Sounds good. Well, Michael, thank you so much for filling in. And thank you, all of you out in DMZ world. And we'll see you back here next week. Thanks again.
Thank you.